That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host, and this week my guest is Jamie Farr. That's right, Corporal Klinger on MASH. Now, as you know, I worked on MASH for 4 years with Jamie, and also another 2 years with Jamie on After MASH. And yes, we will be talking about that too, but primarily, we're going to be talking a lot about MASH, how Jamie got his job in the first place, which is kind of an interesting story, life on the set, doing some special episodes, including Point of View, the one that David Isaacs and I wrote. Also, we'll talk a lot about the final episode of MASH, which became a major national event. This week on Hollywood and Levine, Jamie Farr. Well, you actually served in Korea, didn't you?
I did indeed. I got shipped overseas through Fort Lewis, Washington, and I wound up stationed in Japan and in Korea. Japan, I was with the Armed Forces Radio, and so I had nice duty there, but I had temporary duty several times in Korea. Once to open Armed Forces television in Korea, which was in the dead of winter, and all the jeeps and tanks and everything were frozen by the wayside. And we were supposed to just fly in our group. We had some civilians. Ours was a tri-service unit with Armed Forces Radio there in Asakamachi, Far East Network. And we couldn't get out because it was just too cold. So we had to sleep in the area where they had the luggage. And there was a little potbelly stove there. And we kept our uniforms, you know, on and our clothing on to keep warm. And the next morning they said, okay, we think it's time to take off. You can take off now. And we started. It was a DC-3. And a major strategic commander was the pilot. We just had one pilot. We all got on the airplane. It was a paratrooper's airplane, so there were no seats. There were just benches on the side, corrugated metal on the floor, and little pads to sit
on. It's pretty much Delta Airlines now. Yeah.
Or any of them, to any airline at this point. And that's first class.
Yeah.
So at any rate, we took off, and we're going across the Sea of Japan to get back to Japan, to Tachikawa Air Base there. And the engines start to freeze, and we're at the point of no return. That's a two-engine DC-3, and we're starting to lose altitude, and he's trying to start the engines, and they started giving us parachutes to jump out.
Wow.
Now, first of all, if you jump out and it's that cold, you get hypothermia. You'll die, you know, in the water,
right,
like that. And so everybody turned ashen, even the people that were with Air Force, because they had never jumped out of an airplane.
Right.
And all we kept doing is I kept looking out over it, and I said, oh, my gosh, this is like a John Wayne movie. You know, I'll never come back. I there won't be residuals in my life. There won't be TV shows or anything. And what happened is we kept dropping the altitude, and as we dropped, the ice would come off the wing, and he would keep starting that engine. Ping, you know, ping, and you'd say, please, God, make that thing turn over. And, of course, they pump alcohol also into the wings to de-ice it. And finally, we were just like about 200 feet above the water when all of a sudden the engine started up and we managed to take off. But that was one of the scariest moments I ever had in my life.
I'm sure you must have thought of that when, you know, the Henry Blake situation.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you learned that, you know, his plane, you know, crashed right. in the Sea of Japan.
Yeah, no question about that. That was the one time that we were over there. And then the other time is when Red Skelton asked me to join him from the State Department. I was just a private there in Sakamachi, in the just outside of Tokyo, Japan, to entertain the troops. And because I had worked with him before I had gone into the service. He was like my mentor. And so I got VIP status. We flew over in a United Nations airplane. And we entertained the troops at little camps, not like Bob Hope did with the big TV cameras. Uh-huh. And
well, you didn't have Elkie Summers.
No, yeah. Elkie wasn't there. It was just Red, me, and that Italian fedora hat that he had that he used to wear and use for all different kinds of things. And we went all the way up to the DMZ. So we were at the 38th parallel. And the interesting thing is that the North Koreans had the high ground there. So what the GIs did is they built latrines. So they were overlooking the latrines. Of course, I wouldn't want to be in the latrine if they decided to attack, you know,
right.
at that time. But at least that was what they did to not make it comfortable for the North Koreans to look down upon.
Well, so before MASH, you worked with Red Skelton. You worked on a lot of shows, and checking your IMDb, there were a lot of things where you were delivery guy and stuff like that.
That was just on, as a matter of fact, if you watch MeTV, not only do they have MASH on there, but they have my whole history.
You're like Get Smart. You're like all those shows.
Joy and I were in New York one time, and I went into, I was doing Broadway at that time, and we went into this tape, DVD place. I forgot the name of it. And I said, you know, my first movie was Blackboard Jungle. He says, we have that. And he says, Mr. Farr.
That's a good movie.
Mr. Farr, you're in the nostalgia section. So that's my life, the nostalgia on MeTV. The Love Boats, the Get Smart, I did Lucy, I did Andy Griffith, I did all of those shows. I had a wonderful agent, wonderful name also, Meyer Mishkin, wonderful agent. And at any rate, I haven't told this story before, but when Wild Wild West was they're going to do the pilot because of, Jim West.
Robert Conrad?
Robert Conrad.
Mm-hmm.
He was short. And so for the part that Ross Martin played, they were thinking about getting somebody the same size in that. And I was actually up for that role. Ross did a great job. I work with Ross in some shows. I work with everybody in some show or another. But I was up for that. And then I also was up for, which I haven't told the story, was I actually up for Maynard in Dobie Gillis.
Really?
Yeah, Bob Denver got. And then my career was taken off. I mean, I was in great shape until I got out of the Army, and then nobody would hire me.
Welcome to Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly.
So
what have you done lately?
Yeah.
You know, I said, well, I was, you know, carrying a rifle and saving your bacon here and that. But, that's when Red said, hey, I was going to quit the business. And he said, you're not quitting. And he put me under personal contract. My dad had just passed away, and I was going to have to go home and support my mother because we didn't have any money. And he said, no, he whipped out some $100 bills. He said, here, take them, and you send them home to your mom. And he said, I'll see you up at the house in Bel Air, and you're working for me. And so I was under contract to him for a whole year. Not only did his TV show many times, worked with Peter Lorre and Errol Flynn, George Raft, Boris Karloff, Jane Mansfield, trying to think of all of the other ones, Fabian, Bobby Rydell, you name all of the ones that would be guests at that particular time in my career. That would be 1959. And then also went with him and introduced him. We played the Sands Hotel in Las Vegas, Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami Beach, the Shea Puri in Chicago. with the boys, you know, and a Moulin Rouge here in L.A. It was a wonderful experience, and he was as a second father to me. He was just absolutely wonderful.
So 1972, MASH goes on the air, and the fourth episode is Chief Surgeon Who, and they're looking for a guy to play a corpsman who is trying to get out of the Army by getting a Section 8, and talking to Larry Gelbart, because I said, where did you come up with that? And he said, Lenny Bruce did something like that where he wore a Waves uniform.
It was in the Coast Guard.
Yeah, exactly. And talk a little bit about that audition and that first episode.
I did not audition for that part.
I'll they just you, gave it to you, huh?
I'll tell you how that happened. I was having a rough time of it at that time. I've had ups and downs in this business. I was always being discovered or something was happening, and then it would peter out and nothing would happen. And so at that particular time, a buddy and I were we were trying to create some game shows and do some writing, and I got this phone call from the agency, not Wolfsmeyer, Michigan. It was Lou Deucer. And I had done a F Troop for High Averback, and I played a stand-up comic Indian. They had taken all the Henny Youngman's jokes, and they had taken all of Milton Berle's jokes and made them Indian jokes. So the chief of the Hakawi tribe has auditioning me, you know, for their big event. And Gene Reynolds was the director of the show. And so he got a kick out of all the stuff that I was doing, and it was very, very funny. And, of course, the punchline, Arthur Julian wrote the script. And the punchline is, after I'd auditioned as the comedian for the Hakawi tribe, was he says, the chief says, well, look at don't smoke signal us, we'll smoke signal you, you know. That was the punchline. Well, Gene, whenever he liked an actor or an actress, he had a little book, a little black book, and he'd write the names down of people. And I get this phone call, and it says, hey, there's a show called MASH. It's off of that movie. And I said, geez, I haven't seen the movie, but I heard about it. He said, there's a part in it for you, and Gene Reynolds is directing and or is producing the show. And he said, they want you to come out. It pays $250 for the day. And I said, well, what's the part? He said, well, they'll tell you when they see you. And I said, okay, great. Hey, listen, you know, I had to pay my rent. Joy and I were, you know, only been married for about 8 or 9 years, and I'd been up and down with all kinds of jobs here and there, and we were striving to pay our rent and put food on the table. So I didn't care. I said, great, I'll show up. And I came in, and I met Gene, and he took me into this trailer. And I said, well, what's the part? He says, he said, you see that? I said, yeah. I said, that's a wax outfit and high heels. He says, I said, what am I dressing with a actress here in the dressing room? She says, no, that's yours. I said, what do you mean, mine? He says, yeah, put them on. This is a character. I said, well, what the part? He says, you'll see, you'll find out. So they had the correct sizes or whatever it was. I had the high heels on and my hairy bold legs and that. And he takes me by the hand and he takes me on to stage 9. And it was E.W. Swackhammer that was the director of this
particular. What a great name that is.
I know.
Yeah.
I'd worked for him at Screen Gems, but he was working the episode, The Chief Surgeon Who. Well, Alan and everybody started breaking up. Everybody was laughing, crafts and services and that. And I had no idea yet what I was supposed to say. And they finally handed me the script, and I was looking at it. And he says, well, this guy's trying to get out of the service and that. Then Gene and Larry Gelbart left, and Swackhammer was in charge now. And I said, how do you want me to play? He says, and he had me playing it as a homosexual. He had me lisping and saying, you know,
right.
Oh, who goes there, et cetera, and that. And I did what he told me to do, you know, $250.
Right.
So I did it, and then I get this phone call the next day, and my agent says, Jamie, do you mind going back? They want to reshoot the scenes that you did. And I go, oh, my goodness, I felt so badly. I let Gene down. I mean, what did I do wrong? I did what the director had asked me to do. And they said they'll pay another $250, but they're going to have to reshoot it. So I came in, and Gene and Larry were there, and they said, well, listen, we can't do it that way. That won't work. You know, we can't sustain it. He's not getting out of the Army because he's a homosexual. He's getting out of the Army because he wants them to think they're crazy. He's crazy, and that's how he's going to do it. So how would you play it? And I said, well, now I'm desperate. I want to, you know, keep the
right,
part.
Right.
And I said, well, I play it straight. You know, instead of he makes comments about himself, let the other people make comments about him. Give him a cigar and just let him talk straight, you know. And that's what that's his dress of the day.
It was a great decision, Jamie.
You don't think I stay up nights praying saying, yes, it is. It was a great decision. I said, okay, try it that way. So that's what I did. I just came on, played it absolutely straight, and made no reference to the outfits or anything else. And that first year, they called me back, I think, 6 times. And then when the show got picked up the second year, I did, I think they did 22 shows. I think I did half of them, 11. And then in the third year is when they put me under contract, which I was so grateful for. And as I know you know you're pretty grateful, we both are, for being such an iconic show with such wonderful leaders like Gene and Larry and Bert. And I mean, you know, it's your coach, it's the way they develop the show. And they certainly, now I watched the first year, and they hadn't quite got the formula.
No, they were still learning it, and yeah, they were still experimenting.
But once they got that formula, boy, I got to tell you, it worked so well. I watch the shows now, and I marvel at how wonderful the scripting was, and that includes you as well, and David, your partner, David Isaacs, and the producing that you did. The balance of the show, I mean, you could have a plot, which was very serious, and the B plot would be absolutely burlesque and silly and whatever it was, or you'd switch it. The A plot would be something silly, and the B plot would be something that was very serious. I can't believe the composition, the balance of that show, because you watch a lot of shows today, and they don't have that. You know, either it's all silly, or it's all something that's very serious.
Dramedies that aren't funny.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, exactly right, yeah.
So Larry Gelbart left after the fourth season, and Gene left after the fifth season, mm-hmm. and Gene continued to consult, but then idiots like me and David came along. Let me ask you, was the cast nervous? It's like, oh, my God, who are these people?
No, you know why? I tell you why I don't think we were nervous is because, you know, Jay Fulb was with us, a wonderful writer and script consultant. Larry Marks was with us with Larry Gelbart and everything. So when they started to leave, that's when we got nervous at the beginning. But we found that the show didn't lose what it had. It was getting better in some ways. And I was never fearful after that. I was fearful when Larry Gelbart and Gene left. Then, of course, and then Bert took over. And Bert Metcalf. I'm sorry. I should mention his full name. Yeah, Bert took over. And then the people that he brought, he mentored and kept the Larry Gelbart, Gene Reynolds legacy, you know, with the show. So no, we weren't. I wasn't frightened with Ken Levine and a David Isaacs or a John Rappaport or a Dan Wilcox and a Thad Mumford or something, because the show had settled, got that formula, and the way you looked at it, you just made the shows better. I mean, everybody keeps saying that.
This is why he's my guest, by the way.
Well, I'm honored to be your guest, believe me, Ken.
I have to say that for me and David, you were our favorite character to write for because, number one, you were an everyman, and number two, you had the strongest drive. And it's so good to have a character who not only wants something, but does something about it. I mean, everybody in the 4077 wanted out, but your character was the only one who was actively doing something about it, and it made writing for you very, very easy.
Well, I appreciate it. I watched some of the shows, some of the things they did, I was very pleased with, and some things I wasn't pleased with. But at the same time, you know, to try to take some of the bizarre things that they did and try to make it believable was very difficult at some points, because he was almost a cartoon character.
Right. You never complained, though. I don't ever remember you complaining about a script.
I never complained about any of the things. I am, to this day, I will look back and tell you I am what Gary Cooper said in Pride of the Yankees as Lou Carey. I'm one of the luckiest men on the face of the earth to be with a show like that. And my job was to try to make whatever it was work. And, you know, sometimes you go, how the heck do I do this? And the thing is I remember Gene used to say, it's the Klinger spirit, you know, you got to have that. But the thing is also that what was so much fun about it is the cast was enjoying the writers would come up with for this guy to get out. It was entertaining for them as well, because, I mean, it was the most absurd things that you could think of, you know, immolating yourself.
Yeah, we wrote that one.
Yeah, you know, flying over with a hang glider and...
We had you
up on the flagpole, you know, that one there. And I get comments from all kinds of people about you know, how much fun it was for them to watch it.
Yeah, we had you as an aluminum siding salesman, which my dad did, so he remembered his sales pitch.
Right.
And yeah, we were looking for different things to do to get you out of those dresses. But you wore some pretty famous dresses along the way, didn't you?
I did indeed. Betty Grable, Alice Faye, Dame Mae Whitty. And, of course, my favorite, which I tell this story very often, was a Ginger Rogers one. It was the one that Nurse Kelly Nakahara, we were doing a takeoff on Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, and I had that gold lamé outfit as Ginger Rogers, and she was dressed, and we danced cheek to cheek, you know, with some of the famous numbers. And the night that show aired, the next day, I was in the commissary. We were starting another episode, and Ginger Rogers was there.
Wow.
She was doing a Love Boat for Aaron Spelling. And she saw me, and she came over to me, and she said, Jamie, I saw that show last night where you were wearing one of my dresses. And she said, I want to tell you something. It looked a hell of a lot better on you than it did on me. Just absolutely wonderful.
You did some unique episodes, too. Talk a little bit about The Interview.
Oh, that, you know, people always say, what's your favorite show? And I think Larry was very, very clever. Larry Gelbart, again, I must use the full name, was very clever with that, because he had, it was based on the Edward R. Murrow visit to Korea and the interviews they had. And what he did is he originally took a tape recorder around and interviewed us without a script, and just asked us questions, and we answered.
In character.
In character, exactly right. And so later he went back and he made a transcript out of it, and then had Cleet Roberts, who was absolutely wonderful, who was also, for real, part of that group that had been over there interviewing, I think it was Eric Severide and some of the famous names at that time with Edward R. Murrow, and... and we would try to recreate and try to remember. It still wasn't a script. It was still our ad-libbing that we did. And lo and behold, it was done in black and white. It won the Peabody Award. And to this day, how many shows can you recall where anybody ever did a show like that? Or how about the show that we did? I think you were with the company that time when the projector breaks down and everybody has to get up and do something. That was totally ad lib. There was no script on that one. Remember? Do you remember the
script? Yeah.
When they, and then finally the wounded come in and we all have to run out. But people got up and just did stuff. I mean,
really easy for us. We didn't have to do any writing.
But to trust your performers, you know. to trust the egos of these children that you have to deal with. I found it remarkable and so trusting of our company to do that.
Well, you guys were game for anything. I mean, an episode that David and I wrote that we're so proud of is Point of View.
Oh, great.
And, great. You know, you guys really rose to the challenge. And you're so used to never looking in the camera. And now all of a sudden you have to look into the camera and relate to the camera as if he were a person. You guys did a great job.
Thank you, Ken. Wasn't that Charlie Dubin?
Charlie Dubin
directed it,
yes.
He was one of our regular directors, along with High Averback and Allen and Burt Metcalf and several others. Charlie was wonderful. But is that the one where we had to do everything in one take because other people were coming
yes.
in?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I got to tell you something. One of the most frightening moments I've ever had in my career was that script that you and David wrote, because I was the first person that came out that said something and did whatever it is and then left and then was the last person in the scene to come in to say something. So if I made a mistake at the last part, you'd have to do the whole thing over because there were no cuts.
Right.
It was just done in that one take that they did. And boy, I tell you, I was so nervous. I said, please, Lord, let me say that correctly and the way they wanted me to say it, because otherwise everybody would have to go back and do the whole thing again.
Talk a little bit about the last episode of MASH. 120 million people saw that show, and it was such a national phenomenon. What was that like for you? I mean, the weeks before and the weeks after, what an almost surreal experience that must have been.
It was something that you'll never forget, but it's something that you'd like to forget because we were deluged. PBS... radios, magazines,
like you were the Beatles.
Shows. We were, yeah, exactly right. We were literally, if that's a great comparison, the Beatles. We were so exhausted from talking to news reporters and TV, local TV, all kinds of magazines, Newsweek, Life magazine, everything else, and then had to go back and you know go to work to shoot it, knowing that this was the very last show. And as you know, it wasn't goodbye, farewell, and amen that was the last show.
It was another episode.
It was the last episode is the burying the time capsule. And if you recall, and I think it's on tape someplace, I might have it somewhere, is that there must have been 400 people on that set on stage 9, from all kinds of press, TV and everything, and newspapers and magazines that were all there to see the very last shot when Burt Metcalf, who directed that particular episode, said, cut, that's a print, and that's a wrap. And, oh, my goodness, we were, as you said, deluged with all these people that were on there. And it was very sad because, truthfully, and I hope you knew this, that cast did love each other. Mm-hmm. We loved every single one of them, the original people and the people that replaced them, because they were very unique. They loved what they were doing. They loved all the writing that was in the scripts. And even with all the doctoring and everything else done, the respect that they had for you as producers and writers and directors and what we were trying to do as actors to make something work that we would be proud of, and which we are now today. You look back on it and you say, hey, you know what? We did all right. We did a good job. But, it was very difficult to have to say goodbye to those people. It was also exciting to figure out, well, what's going to happen to me now?
Well, yeah. What happened to you then happened to me, which was Aftermath.
Yeah.
And, you know, I make fun of Aftermath a lot on the podcast and blog because it's something to make fun of. But, you know, looking back, those weren't actually bad shows. And Larry Gelbart created it and was there the first year. That was the reason why we signed a board. It's like Sandy Koufax saying, hey, kid, I'll teach you pitching.
I agree. That's what happened to me and Harry and Bill and Rosalind Chow, who was wonderful in MASH and also in After MASH. What I had hoped it to be and what I kept saying to Larry, I you know, I didn't have the credentials that Alan Alda had. I hadn't been on Broadway and, you know, been in hit movies and all kinds of stuff.
You were on F Troop. Come on.
I was on F Troop.
You were on F Troop.
But what I said is I wanted it to be the best years of our lives. And what I thought would have been great is if we had all wound up like at Schofield Barracks, where the service people were coming back. What happened was when I say they, that'd be part of your guys and that, we're making the people different, making our characters different. We didn't have the spirit that we did. And I certainly, you know, didn't have the credentials to say anything about it, but I still thought it was a great show and could have been good. The balance. What I think happened was that the emphasis went on the newer characters that they brought in to be our opponents, you know, and what we were trying mm-hmm. to do. And I think that emphasis came on top of them rather than kept us being part of what we should be doing. So, but look, that's hearsay. How many shows, my goodness, that we've all been in, I'm sure that wouldn't it be great if we all had great successes their whole lives? Marlon Brando didn't have great successes all of his life. Laurence Olivier didn't. There are some shows that just didn't work.
And you've done a lot of things since, but I'm sure you're recognized to this day. People come up and talk about MASH.
Yes, quite frequently. Well, how can you not? I mean, it's on MeTV, Sundance TV, WGN. It's on all over.
TV Land, too.
TV Land. That's right. You're absolutely right. TV Land.
Yeah, I check my residuals.
Yes, yeah. The marathons, you know, that they have and so forth. It's a wonderful show. I mean, and I say that with great pride, not because I'm in it, but I still enjoy it. You know, some of the scenes. I always tell people, you know, some of the people that were unsung on that. My character is easy because, you know, he was such a showy guy. But you think Bill Christopher as Father Mulcahy, my goodness, he had such wonderful moments in that show. And, oh, my goodness, David Ogden Stiers, all the highs and lows he hit with that character. And, of course, you know, Mike Farrell replacing Wayne Rogers and Alan. Consistency with all of the new characters that came in. To me, it just was just a remarkable replacements that they had. And I loved the original, McLean Stevenson and Larry Linville. At the same time, and of course, Wayne. But at the same time, you treasure the ones that replaced them because they came in different and added so much again to the show.
You mentioned watching an episode or two. Do you still watch the episodes from time to time?
Yes, I do. In particular, some of the ones that I'm not in. Because you go, oh, okay, I didn't really pay attention to that one and that. And some of them are just so wonderful. The guest actors that were used on the show, some of them were just terrific, the scenes that they had. It was so well written, and what a compliment to you and David and to John Rappaport and to Thad Mumford and Dan Wilcox and Jay Fulb and Larry and Ronnie Graham. Mm-hmm. Larry, was it Balmaggia?
Balmaggia,
yeah. See, I remember all
yeah,
of the guys.
Yeah, you do.
And they were all wonderful. Dennis Kaney. Oh, my goodness. Some of the scripts that he came up with, that Tontine one with Harry. I mean, the brilliance that you kept us on the air. You all did. you kept us there. And the reason we went off is because we were all frightened that we couldn't duplicate the best we did.
Jamie, this has really been a treat. Thank you so much. And again, it was just such a pleasure working with you those years and writing for you. I'm so thrilled to see you again.
Well, I am thrilled to be here, and I am also thrilled to be associated with you and David and all the wonderful, wonderful people that made that show work. We're still in touch. You know, there's only five of us left now. There's Alan and Mike Farrell, Loretta, Gary, and myself. We miss all of the other people. They were such great contributors. I hope you fell in love with them as much as we did.
Oh, absolutely.
Harry Morgan and Bill Christopher and David Ogden Stiers. You didn't work with McLean.
I did work with Larry Linville.
Okay, Larry, yeah.
And all the others.
Oh, gosh. I sometimes it's hard for me at my age now. I turned 85, and I'll watch not only our show, and I'll miss all the people that we mentioned, but I'll be watching, like, on MeTV to go to sleep, Hogan's Heroes, let's say. And I worked with all those people. And, you know, Larry Marks, who was on our show, wrote a lot of the shows. Gene Reynolds directed. So I worked with Werner Klimper, and I worked with John Banner, and I worked with Robert Clary and those. And it makes me very sad because a lot of those people, Robert's still with us, but Werner and Bob Crane.
Long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. And I say, well, I better turn it off now. I'm starting to get nostalgic.
Thanks, Jamie.
My pleasure. My pleasure, Ken.
And I must tell you, the way that Jamie was in that interview, that's the way he is all the time. I mean, he is just a nice, nice guy. Okay, that'll do it for this week. Our thanks, as always, to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, Howard Hoffman, John Wolfert, and Bruce and Jason Miller. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I don't know why you're not, for God's sakes. Come on, I keep plugging this every week, at Ken Levine. Also, I'm on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine, and I have an email address if you want to get a hold of me. That is HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com, HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. Okay, let's see what else. Subscribe if you haven't, and please give me a 5-star review if you haven't. We'll be back again next week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. Hollywood and Levine.